Have you ever caught yourself staring at a travel brochure, lost in fantasies of white sand beaches and swaying palms?
That moment when gray skies press against your window and somewhere, anywhere, feels like salvation?
This longing isn't just about geography.
It's about possibility itself.
Consider what happens before any journey begins.
You're still at home, flipping through glossy images, but already you're traveling.
The anticipation creates its own pleasure, sometimes more potent than the destination itself.
A 19th century character named Dessessaints once planned a trip to London. En route to his ship, he stopped at an English tavern in Paris.
Surrounded by roast beef, ale, and British tourists, he realized something startling. The London he'd imagined already existed in his mind.
Why bother with the actual journey when his chair provided such magnificent travel?
This reveals travel's first paradox.
We're not really fleeing our location, we're fleeing ourselves.
That Caribbean brochure promises more than turquoise water. It sells the fantasy of becoming someone different. Someone unburdened by work stress and relationship tensions.
Yet here's the uncomfortable truth. You arrive at paradise, and within hours find yourself in the same argument you might have had at home.
The luxury surroundings become irrelevant because you've packed your psychological baggage alongside your swimsuit.
Ancient philosophers understood what we keep forgetting. Happiness depends less on where you are than who you are.
Most dismiss airports and train stations as necessary evils, yet these in-between spaces hold their own poetry. The 19th century poet Baudelaire suffered from the horror of home, a perpetual restlessness that made him dream of distant lands. Ironically, actual travel left him dejected. He discovered something curious. He found more solace watching ships in harbors than sailing on them. Departure screens whispered promises of transformation. These liminal spaces captivate us because they embody pure possibility. Standing in an airport, watching planes lift skyward, you're reminded how easily your life could shift. Just walk down that corridor, board that craft, become someone else. American painter Edward Hopper captured this in his roadside diners and gas stations, floodlit stations against encroaching darkness, the last outpost before wilderness. These places strip away social pretense. Movement itself facilitates thinking. The practical part of your mind gets occupied with logistics and scenery, allowing deeper reflections to surface. Your best insights often arrive while staring out a train window at blurring landscape.
At Amsterdam's airport, a simple yellow Aankomst sign triggers unexpected delight, not from design, but because it signals arrival elsewhere. This is the exotic. The thrilling sense that this country might prove more congenial to your temperament than your birthplace. Young Gustave Flaubert felt this intensely about Egypt. Growing up in provincial France, he despised bourgeois society's artistic suspicion, sexual repression, and suffocating propriety. When inheritance enabled travel, he gulped down Egypt like a donkey filling himself with hay. What makes somewhere truly exotic? In Amsterdam, you might find it in elongated pale pink bricks or narrow apartment blocks. Standing before a red door, you experience intense longing, not because it's objectively superior, but because it validates something your own culture rejects. For Flaubert, Egypt confirmed beliefs his society scorned. He embraced Cairo's chaos as proof that life is fundamentally disordered. He celebrated Egyptian culture's bodily frankness, animals in cafes, public urination, as acceptance of life's duality. Shit and mind, death and life, sexuality and purity, coexisting without shame. When leaving Egypt, Flaubert was distraught. When will I see a palm tree again? Perhaps nationality should be determined by affinity rather than birth. Though from Rouen, Flaubert might have answered he was, perhaps a little, from Egypt, too.
In Madrid for a conference, lethargy strikes. Despite renowned attractions waiting outside. This contrasts with Alexander von Humboldt, who spent 5 years in South America collecting 1,600 plants and identifying 600 new species. Venturing into Madrid's old quarter,
Guidebook's acts feel hollow. The Plaza Mayor's northern side measures 101.52 meters. Philip III's statue stands 5.43 meters high. Unlike Humboldt's measurements that served science, these observations seem pointless. What should we seek in our travels? Not facts to collect, but small, life-enhancing thoughts for psychological enrichment. Imagine creating your own subjective Madrid guide, giving 3 stars to vegetables' underrepresentation in Spanish cuisine, surprisingly long surnames, men's small feet. These personal interests would form your authentic guide if curiosity followed its natural course. Humboldt's attention to seemingly insignificant details, lichens above the snow line, a butterfly at 15,000 feet, stemmed from his lifelong inquiry about how geography affects life. The difference between swatting a fly and using it to develop botanical theory depends entirely on what you're asking of the world. Only by linking details to fundamental questions can travelers develop the receptivity needed to truly see.
William Wordsworth walked 175,000 miles through England's Lake District, finding inspiration in overlooked natural phenomena. He critiqued cities for breeding social anxiety and insatiable desire for novelty. In every landscape, Wordsworth found models of virtue. Flowers exemplified humility. Animals demonstrated stoicism. Nature's majesty encourages high-mindedness, making petty emotions harder to sustain. Wordsworth termed powerful natural experiences spots of time, moments retaining renovating virtue that lifts us up when fallen. Trees observed near Ambleside later returned during a London traffic jam, providing a ledge against which I could rest my thoughts. Nature equips us with internal sanctuaries we can access anywhere. Desert landscapes offer a specific gift, to be made to feel small. Not in the unpleasant way social hierarchies diminish us, but satisfyingly, as suggested by overwhelming romantic landscapes. Edmund Burke distinguished between merely beautiful landscapes and truly sublime ones, suggesting power greater than humans.
What defies our will can provoke anger or awe, depending on whether the obstacle appears noble or squalid. We begrudge the cocky doorman, but honor the mist-shrouded mountain. Sublime landscapes allow us to conceive a familiar inadequacy differently. When Job demands to know why he suffers, God directs him to contemplate deserts and mountains. Accept what you cannot understand. Even for secular minds, sublime landscapes help us accept without bitterness the obstacles we cannot overcome.
We've forgotten how to truly see in our image-saturated world. We visit famous places and snap photos, collecting evidence without genuine encounter. The secret to possessing beauty isn't capturing it, it's understanding it. Vincent van Gogh spent 15 months in Arles, producing 200 paintings, 100 drawings, and 200 letters to help others see Provence's essence. After reading about Van Gogh at a Provencal guesthouse, the next morning brings discovery. 2 large cypresses at the garden's edge suddenly reveal their distinctive movement in the mistral wind. Olive trees transform from squat bushes to angular forms with trident trunks and alert, energetic leaves. John Ruskin reached a radical conclusion. Beauty can only be possessed through understanding it, best developed by drawing beautiful places, regardless of talent. Drawing teaches us to notice rather than merely look. A window reveals itself not as a simple object, but as a complex assembly of ledges, ridges, indentations, 12 subtly rectangular panes, and paint varying in hue with light. Drawing offers another benefit, conscious understanding of our attraction to certain landscapes. We move from vague appreciation to precise analysis, formulating personal laws of beauty, light striking objects from the side, gray complementing green, specific architectural proportions. We develop a vocabulary for our own taste.
Returning to London from Barbados, the city remains stubbornly unchanged. Azure skies and baby turtles replaced by rain and funereal clouds. This contrast reveals the world's indifference to personal transformation. Yet Xavier de Maistre's Journey Around My Bedroom offers profound insight. While Alexander von Humboldt required 10 mules and 30 luggage pieces for exploration, de Maistre needed only pink and blue pajamas. Our pleasure in journeys depends more on mindset than destination. This traveling mindset combines receptivity and humility, approaching places without rigid ideas about what's interesting. At home, habituation blinds us. We assume we've discovered everything interesting simply because we've lived there long. Applying de Maistre's principles to a Hammersmith neighborhood, forcing yourself to look as though seeing it for the first time, reawakens attention. Nietzsche observed that some people make much of little, while others merely make little of much. The art of travel isn't reaching new destinations, but cultivating curiosity and attentiveness. The greatest journey isn't to somewhere else, it's into deeper seeing, fuller presence, more conscious wonder. Start where you are. Look again.